And thank you so much, Caitlin, for such a moving talk. I was whispering to River that I think I need a calm corner. And then River whispered back, "You're sitting in my calm corner," because I'm sitting in their meditation spot. So I was giggling during your talk, that's why. As many of you know, my name is Jess. My Dharma name is Shingetsu. And tonight I'm going to talk about joyful rest. So I invite you to take a restful, comfy, cozy position so you can experience the theme firsthand. During this year's practice period, some of you may remember that Kaku Kokei gave a really beautiful talk about Virya Paramita, the perfection of joyful effort. And her talk really opened something up for me. Kay emphasized that joyful effort is important, but so is resting joyfully. I've been thinking a lot about joyful rest during this holiday season, and I've also been thinking about how much I resist rest. I know I'm not alone in this struggle. We live in a culture that tells us to go nonstop, to buy more, do more, be more. It's a culture of exhaustion. This Saturday, I was only a few hours into my Christmas vacation when I found myself furiously scribbling a lengthy list of everything I wanted to accomplish on my so-called time off. Oh, I wanted to knit a hat, start writing this talk, make homemade cannelloni for Christmas, write some poems, answer emails that have been languishing in my inbox past their due date, buy a desk, which I meant to do back in March, clean out my closet of chaos. As I stared down at my list, it was all I could do not to cry. But I decided to laugh instead, because I've gone through some version of this experience almost every December of my adult life. And it always reminds me of my favorite article published in The Onion, which is a satirical news website. And the headline of the article is this: "Plan to straighten out entire life during week-long vacation yields mixed results." I think my urge to get a lot done during my December vacation is in part a reaction to my exhaustion from the year. For me, fatigue often manifests as a frenzied, manic, kind of obsessive energy. I have a friend who says everything you need to know about yourself is written in your kindergarten report card. Here's what my kindergarten teachers had to say about me. "Jessica is really wonderful to be around, except when she's hungry or tired." River can attest that these comments still hold true to this day. I remain very impressed at how well my kindergarten teachers summed me up, and in so few words. River and I have a running joke that is not really a joke about how I become useless at 9 p.m. According to my parents, I was this way even as a very young child. No matter what I was doing, I would basically collapse at 9. Thankfully, I can now stay up past 9, but I'm still prone to tears at night. Years ago, River found me one night raging at a bin of winter clothes because I couldn't fit the lid back onto it. River gently took the lid from my hands that evening, effortlessly closed the bin, and put me right to bed. When my body tells me that it's time to rest and I don't listen, I always end up paying the price. I have a long history of breaking things at night. My favorite teacup, River's favorite mug. During this practice period, Kaku Kokei taught me a lot about the importance of listening to my body, including its need for rest. As Rumi writes so beautifully in his poem, Body Intelligence, "Your intelligence is always with you, overseeing your body, even though you may not be aware of its work. If you start to do something against your health, your intelligence will eventually scold you. If it hadn't been so lovingly close by and so constantly monitoring, how could it rebuke? The intelligence of my body knows when I need to rest, and it scolds me when I do not. The importance of rest is emphasized in many spiritual traditions. Wayne Mueller describes the Christian Sabbath in these terms. Sabbath requires surrender. If we only stop when we are finished with all of our work, we will never stop because our work is never completely done. With every accomplishment, there arises a new responsibility. Sabbath dissolves the artificial urgency of our days because it liberates us from the need to be finished. This attitude towards work reminds me of the work period in the Soto Zen tradition. When River and I lived at Little Tea Temple in Calgary, we would meditate for 30 minutes every morning, have a short service, and then it was time for Soji, temple cleaning. We would clean the temple for 10 minutes, fully immersing ourselves in the task, and then our priest would ring the temple bell and cleaning time was over. The work of cleaning the temple is never completely done, but when the bell rang, it was done for the day. In Judaism, the importance of rest is symbolized in Shabbat, the period of rest that starts at sundown on Friday and ends at sundown on Saturday. My dad is Jewish and my mom is Catholic, and we didn't celebrate Shabbat at my home when I was growing up. But my best friend from childhood, Lily, is Jewish, and I spent many Friday evenings around her family's dining room table, singing the Shabbat prayers, sipping sweet wine, and tearing off large warm pieces of homemade challah. I have such fond memories of sharing Shabbat dinner with Lily and her family, the tall candles casting soft light on our faces, our giddiness, which was mostly put on after sipping the wine. My cousin is the most observant Jew in my immediate family. On his wedding night, he spoke so tenderly about the importance of Shabbat to him and his wife. When my cousin met his wife, he was a medical resident and his mom was in the hospital dying of cancer. My cousin spent almost all of his time in the hospital, either working or visiting his mom, and he had very little time to spare. But he wasn't allowed to work on Shabbat, and so he spent Saturdays going on long walks with a lovely woman who would one day become his wife. It was on these walks that they fell in love. Their partnership would not have been possible without this day of rest. Several years after their wedding, I was at my cousin's house on Shabbat. By that time, my cousin was a doctor, his wife was a social worker, and they lived in a huge house and had two beautiful children. I thought they must have a perfect life. My cousin and his wife are quite observant, and they won't even use a telephone or drive a car on Shabbat. I was telling my cousin's wife that day how much I liked the idea of Shabbat, and without missing a beat, she turned to me and said, "Oh, your cousin and I wouldn't still be married if it weren't for Shabbat. It's the only day he stops working. We spent the whole day together as a family." For my cousin and his wife, Shabbat was not only the foundation of their marriage, it's also what saved it. Religion teaches us about the importance of rest, but so does science. My dad recently listened to a podcast about the science of sleep, and he shared many interesting facts with me. On the one hand, sleep seems a bit misguided from an evolutionary perspective. Why would we spend a full third of our lives sleeping, i.e. a third of our lives not doing anything of use, apparently, and unable to protect ourselves? But every living creature sleeps, even insects, so it must be important. Sleep deprivation has devastating effects. In fact, we tolerate food deprivation better than sleep deprivation. Lack of sleep is associated with many health conditions, including heart disease, mental health disorders, and cancer. I work as a lawyer, and my profession is not exactly known for valuing rest. Perhaps the most important lesson I learned in law school was taught to me by my legal philosophy professor. The lesson came in the form of a question. My professor asked me, "When did productivity become a virtue?" I was so confused by this question. It was obvious to me that productivity must all have always been a virtue, that getting stuff done was important. What could he possibly be going on about? I had not yet considered the ways that productivity is tied to capitalism, or how strange it is to aspire to increase your rate of output, rather than aspiring to be kind, wise, or generous. When we strive to be productive, we strive to fill the world with more products, or perhaps we strive to become a product ourselves. These days, I work as a human rights lawyer for the BC Civil Liberties Association. I am incredibly fortunate that my boss and my workplace value work-life balance and rest. But even with the support of colleagues, it's still easy to get swept up in the wave of overwork. The issues we work on at the BCCLA include prisoners' rights, the rights of young people, the rights of people seeking medical assistance in dying. This year, we went to court to challenge a law reducing benefits for young adults raised in foster care. We also sued the RCMP commissioner for preventing the release of a watchdog report about spying on pipeline protesters. Because we work on such pressing issues, it can be hard to step away from my work at 5 p.m. to listen to the ring of the temple bell. My need for rest often seems less important than fighting injustice. It's been even harder to step away from work during the pandemic. As I recently heard someone say, right now we're not so much working at home as living at work. The boundaries between our work lives and our personal lives have become so blurred. This was thrown into sharp relief for me recently when I kissed River during their Zoom staff meeting that I didn't realize was going on. And yes, their video was turned on. When you are trying to make the world a better place, it's easy to forget to take time to rest. As Thomas Merton writes, there is a pervasive form of contemporary violence to which the idealist most easily succumbs, activism and overwork. The rush and pressure of modern life are a form, perhaps the most common form, of its innate violence. To allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit oneself to too many projects, to want to help everyone in everything is to succumb to violence. The frenzy of our activism neutralizes our work for peace. It destroys our own inner capacity for peace. It destroys the fruitfulness of our own work because it kills the root of inner wisdom, which makes our work fruitful. There are so many suffering beings in this world, and as Zen practitioners, we vow to save them all. But we are also taught that this vow is impossible, and that in the absolute sense, no one needs to be saved. The paradoxes of the Zen tradition bring me great comfort. They remind me that I'm not alone on this path and that in some ways, there's no difference between wholeheartedly arguing an important human rights case and wholeheartedly cozying up with a good book. Both activities are sacred. The kind of heart I bring to the way I offer my life matters immensely. Zen practice has also taught me to open up to my own Buddha nature, to my inherent self-worth. Even if I haven't fixed the climate crisis today or taken out the trash, I'm still worthy of rest. I have begun to think of Zazen as a kind of joyful rest, time where I can just be with myself and daydream or worry or reminisce or remember something really important or forget something really important or just hang out with my breath. It's time where all I am doing is being, and I'm declaring that very simple act to be valuable. When I first started practicing Zen, my priest, Tim, told me that Zazen is useless. I definitely looked at him sideways when he said that. But over time, I have come to deeply appreciate the uselessness of Zazen. Norman Fisher writes about this uselessness so beautifully in his book, What is Zen? To sustain our efforts over time, we have to be able to rest in uselessness. For me, uselessness is the essential character of all spiritual practice. If it's spiritual practice, it must be useless. That is, it won't improve your looks, your health, your livelihood, your intelligence. It won't help the world. You do it just to do it, literally uselessly. But its uselessness is exactly its usefulness. Exactly, because you are not trying to get something out of it, but are doing it merely to do it, it refreshes, it changes your life. For me, a life of helping others usefully is only sustainable when I have useless spiritual practice to keep me afloat, and to remind me that even in the end, the useful is useless. Another place that I find joyful rest is when I am canoeing. It's actually quite fitting that I spent all of today out on a canoe for the first time in months. When I returned home, I noticed how light I felt. A tiredness I have been carrying for a long time had finally lifted. I think my mom is the first person who taught me about the importance of rest. I remember her telling me when I was very young, you must set aside some time where you don't owe anything to anyone. She got this idea from the poet David White. When I was still in school, I found that kind of time in the summer when I would travel to New Orleans to spend time with my dad and my stepmom. Almost all of my friends lived in Montreal, where I lived with my mom during the school year, so I could get a bit lonely sometimes being away from them all summer. But mostly it was wonderful to spend the summer on my own, crafting and reading and writing poems. It was a time when poems would wake me up in the night, and I would rush in the dark to my notebook to write them down. Writing poetry still brings me great joy, and I find that I need rest, quiet, and time on my own in order for this practice to flourish. Much of my inspiration for poetry comes to me during Zazen or from my dreams. Of course, in our world, time for rest is a privilege, not a right. That's why we must continue to fight for a high minimum wage, for sick days and vacation days for workers, for universal daycare. And those of us who have the privilege of having time to rest should take care not to squander this time. The difficulty of accepting rest could be viewed as a kind of bourgeois suffering, and maybe it is. But I think resting is more than some self-care fad. When I rest, it's much easier for me to keep my bodhisattva vows, to offer my life to the well-being of others generously. I am still learning how to make space for joyful rest in my life. I think this will be a lifelong practice for me. But I know I am not alone in my endeavor to embrace rest. I will close with one last quote, this one from E.B. White. I arise in the morning torn between a desire to improve or save the world and a desire to enjoy or savor the world. This makes it hard to plan the day. I'm still not very good at planning my days, but I'm trying to make time to save the world and savor it, and I'm opening my mind to the possibility that these two activities are more similar than I think. Thank you.